welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 8th of 1995, and in the Creekside Room this afternoon, we have Gail Eifrig, and she will be speaking on literary feasts and emphasizing service. So let's go listen in as Gail starts her lecture this day.
Someone asked me this morning if I had been asked to drop the session on sensuousness, which was on the schedule. And I assured him no, that I had not been asked to drop it. In fact, I'd worked it into so many other sessions that I figured it wasn't worth doing a specific one on that subject, because I'm not doing all 10 sessions, and so I've collapsed several into one. So I really thought that on the day that we did the topic of intimacy, and then also certainly when we did the topic of sacrifice and healing, and we read Like Water for Chocolate, that passage is plenty sensuous enough to occupy that slot. So yesterday we looked at reward, and I certainly had fun.
What time is this today?
Yes, is today Tuesday? What day is it? It's Timelessness Day in Literary Feasts. And so today I would like to talk about Child's Christmas in Wales, which is the one that you have in front of you. I also brought, just to share with you, the book that I brought up with me of The Wind and the Willows, because it's the one I grew up with and has in it the illustrations that I best love and the ones that form, of course, the way I think of these animals. And there isn't a picture. Oh, there is a picture of, remember, this very early on we talked about the section in Wind in the Willows called Dulce Domum, where Ratty goes home to his own house and Mole goes home to his own house, and Ratty fixes him the dinner, which eventually turns into a feast, a kind of homecoming feast. And this is I'll leave that the book at that picture. And then the other picture is a wonderful one of Badger showing Ratty and Mole to their room, and the Badger, wonderful Badger sequence that we read fairly recently. So just for fun, there are the way I think of Wind in the Willows and these wonderful illustrations by Arthur Rackham. But today's subject, I have two things I want to have us pay attention to, I guess, for a while. And one is number 6 in the handout, which is just before the Shane one that we did yesterday. And I have loose pages and they're all mixed up. Is this it? Yes, it begins. And I have made selections from this, so have made it very short. But I have included the first section and the last. And so it begins, "One Christmas was so much like another in those years around the sea town corner now and out of all sound," on page 14. And ends on page 15 with the wonderful passage, which I wouldn't want to read out of order. So we'll get to it. Timelessness. It seemed to me, as I thought about feasting and the way it appears in literary texts, that one of the qualities that is consistent, or that at least comes up enough times to make it seem an element of the whole subject and not just a characteristic of one particular feast or another, is the quality that I have called timelessness, although that may not be quite the right word, and maybe among us this afternoon will come up with a better one. That quality in which that present moment gathers up and contains all past moments, or at least a great many past moments, and also contains within it, or seems to contain within it, the promise, the indication of futures, the sense of an ongoingness, so that the feast itself becomes a kind of generative occasion. It doesn't just sit there on its own. It bears within it the seeds of the future. But it also contains all the past, and it seems to exist in itself, not in any particular piece of chronology, but instead in a kind of non-time moment. Hard to talk about. Stephen Hawking could do this much better than I, and talk about how a piece of time and a given present could be so very much chronological. And I thought that was illustrated even in Babette's Feast, particularly if at no other time than at the time where the general gives his toast. Because in that wonderful moment where he is recognizing something very important about his life and the choices that he made, there is a sense there, and in the scene where he and she take farewell of each other, and he says that he will not see her again, but in that moment, right at this feasting moment, all of what he felt was sort of wrong or wrong-headed or wrong-directed about his past, all of that sort of collapses into this moment of the present and becomes not just a lost thing, not a bad thing. His choices, which he made, which are in some sense irrevocable, he gets both what he asked for and what he rejected. And there is a sense, too, that that is a moment. So that present moment does something to the past. It moves the past sort of off the place that it was and changes the nature of the past. I think that one finds in many versions of that kind of thing in accounts of feasting. Remember, too, that in the passage from Adam Bede had that same wonderful sense at the opening there where Eliot talks about people wanting, they were going to celebrate the young squire's coming of age party. And so this central section of the novel is the squire's 21st birthday. And the villagers, as they get ready to celebrate it, are happy to be able to tap the keg of ale that they made when he was born. And that at the time they were born, they said to themselves, we will have this when the heir comes of age, when he's 21. And now, at this moment of the novel, the present moment, those same people are looking back to the time when they made that ale and thought about this present moment. And then there is the sense of the future also. So there's a wonderful little indication of that sense in which the feast gathers up time, but also somehow smooths out differences between times. And that always strikes me as something kind of implicit in this passage from Dylan Thomas. And he puts it like this: one Christmas was so much like another in those years around the sea town corner now and out of all sound except the distant speaking of the voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and 6 nights when I was 12 or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. I think that's so simple, and it does seem like a child. It's so natural. Yet it seems to me also a very sophisticated view of what festival, celebration, feasting accomplishes in a way. It in some sense denies our attachment to chronology and to ordinary organized time. And that little statement about snowing for 6 days and six nights when I was 12. Time and the measurements of time just don't matter. And it's an essential quality of the thing that is being lifted up here for our attention, that's true about it. All the Christmases roll down toward the two-tongued sea like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street. And they stop at the rim of the ice-edged, fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hands in the snow and bring out whatever I can find. In goes my hand into that wool-white, bell-tongued ball of holidays resting at the rim of the carol-singing sea, and out come Mrs. Prothero and the firemen. Of course, that's such a wonderful passage, and it's long and terrific. And if you don't know it, you should go and find it. It's best, of course, if you listen to Dylan Thomas himself read it. And there follows a very funny and wonderful story about it. Mrs. Prothero and the firemen, and Mr. Prothero's aunt, who comes down the stairs, and there's been a fire in the sitting room, and the boys come in and throw snowballs at the fire, and the firemen all come in and are shooting their hoses off and everything, and Mr. Prothero's sister, who's living with them, comes down the stairs. He says she was always a wonderful lady who always knew what to say in any situation, and she looks at all this mess and the smoke and the singed things and the burned things and the firemen standing there and all their things and the hoses, and she says, "Would you like anything to read?" That's my response to any emergency. I always feel a great deal of sympathy with Miss Prothero. But that forms this story. And here, too, in this second paragraph, the one I just read, there's a wonderful erasure of time, at least an erasure of chronology. Because Thomas says he doesn't remember this story about Mrs. Prothero and the fireman because it happened at any particular time, nor does he attach it to any time. He plunges his hand into this ball that is the ball of holidays resting at the rim of the sea. So that it's not calendar, it's some other thing altogether. And he plunges his hand in there and pulls out this one, skein, and that becomes then the subject of what he next does. Well, after he has told that wonderful story, he then begins a poetic meditation, in some sense, on the elements of the feast of Christmas Day itself. Starting with the kind of dialogue with a little boy. Were there uncles like in our house? There are always uncles at Christmas, the same uncles. And on Christmas mornings, with dog-disturbing whistle and sugar fags, I would scour the swatch town for the news of the little world and find always a dead bird by the white post office or by the deserted swings, perhaps a robin, all but one of his fires out. Men and women waiting or scooping back from chapel with taproom noses and wind-bust cheeks, all albinos huddled their stiff black jarring feathers against the irreligious snow. Mistletoe hung from the gas brackets in all the front parlors. There was sherry and walnuts and bottled beer and crackers by the dessert spoons, and cats in their furabouts watched the fires, and the high-heaped fires spat, all ready for the chestnuts and the mulling pokers. Some few large men sat in the front parlors without their collars, uncles almost certainly, trying their new cigars, holding them out judiciously at arm's length, returning them to their mouths, coughing, then holding them out again as though waiting for the explosion. And some few small ants, not wanted in the kitchen, or anywhere else for that matter, sat on the very edges of their chairs, poised and brittle, afraid to break, like faded cups and saucers. This goes on to recount, and in the same kind of collapsed time sense, what the day would be like, and this house, a small house, filled with people, filled with warmth and heat and food, and fire. Not the fire in the Protheroes, but the gas fire of the stove. In the middle of the next column, for dinner, we had turkey and blazing pudding, and after dinner, the uncles sat in front of the fire, loosened all buttons, put their large, moist hands over their watch chains, groaned a little, and slept. Mothers, aunts, and sisters scuttled to and fro, bearing tureens. Auntie Bessie, who had already been frightened twice by a clockwork mouse, whimpered at the sideboard and had some elderberry wine. The dog was sick. Auntie Dosie had to have 3 aspirins, but Auntie Hannah, who liked port, stood in the middle of the snowbound backyard, singing like a big-bosomed thrush. I would blow up balloons to see how big they would blow up to, and when they burst, which they all did, the uncles jumped and rumbled. In the rich and heavy afternoon, the uncles breathing like dolphins and the snow descending, I would sit among festoons and Chinese lanterns and nibble dates and try to make a model man-of-war, following the instructions for little engineers, and produce what might be mistaken for a seagoing tram car. Then it's a wonderful piece where the boy leaves the household and goes out with his friends. We returned home through the poor streets where only a few children fumbled with bare red fingers in the wheel-rutted snow, and catcalled after us, their voices fading away, as we trudged uphill into the cries of the dock birds and the hooting of ships out in the whirling bay. And then, at tea, the recovered uncles would be jolly, and the ice cake loomed in the center of the table like a marble grave. Auntie Hannah laced her tea with rum because it was only once a year. Bring out the tall tales now that we told by the fire as the gaslight bubbled like a diver. Ghosts hooed like owls in the long nights when I dared not look over my shoulder. Animals lurked in the cubbyhole under the stairs where the gas meter ticked. And I remember that we went singing carols once when there wasn't the shaving of a moon to light the flying streets. At the end of a long road was a drive that led to a large house, and we stumbled up the darkness of the drive that night, each one of us afraid, each one holding a stone in his hand in case, and all of us too brave to say a word. The wind through the trees made noises as of old and unpleasant, maybe web-footed men wheezing in caves. We reached the black bulk of the house. What shall we give them? Hark the herald. No, Jack said. Good King Wenceslas, I'll count 3. 1, 2, 3, and we began to sing, our voices high and seemingly distant in the snow-felted darkness round the house that was occupied by nobody we knew. We stood close together near the dark door. Good King Wenceslas looked out on the feast of Stephen. And then a small, dry voice, like the voice of someone who has not spoken for a long time, joined our singing. A small, dry, eggshell voice from the other side of the door. A small, dry voice through the keyhole. And when we stopped running, we were outside our house. The front room was lovely. Balloons floated under the hot water bottle gulping gas. Everything was good again and shone over the town. Perhaps it was a ghost, Jim said. Perhaps it was trolls, Dan said, who was always reading. Let's go in and see if there's any jelly left, Jack said, and we did that. Always on Christmas night there was music. An uncle played the fiddle, a cousin sang Cherry Ripe, and another uncle sang Drake's drum. It was very warm in the little house. Auntie Hannah, who had got on to the parsnip wine, sang a song about bleeding hearts and death, and then another in which she said her heart was like a bird's nest, and then everybody laughed again, and then I went to bed. Looking through my bedroom window out into the moonlight and the unending smoke-colored snow, I could see the lights in the windows of all the other houses on our hill and hear the music rising from them up the long, steadily falling night. I turned the gas down. I got into bed. I said some words to the close and holy darkness, and then I slept. What a wonderful passage. And certainly what Thomas calls to our attention in this passage, among many things, is that that this is no particular time, and yet the particularity of the details make it absolutely real and specific, and yet that reality and that specificness exist outside of chronology, I would maintain. And it's his insistence on the kind of simultaneous reality that this is every Christmas and that this is a specific Christmas that kind of help us to see it in a way that time is canceled out. And the feasting, which goes on here, the actual mentions of food, I think we can hear in some of these details things that we've heard before in Wind in the Willows. Maybe it's not quite like Babette's Feast. It seems to be much more British than French, certainly. But there is a strong sense of the goodness, the abundance, the richness, the tradition, what's gone on in the past. There are other things. What other things did you notice here that strike you about feasting as Thomas makes it part of this piece? Other things that strike you?
I have visions of the kind of feasting we did as a child, you know. And I was just thinking in my aunt's house, she would always make duck because they had ducks out there and making chicken or something. But the children would eat on the stairways, and I was just remembering my plates being there, and I'm wondering now, as an adult, I wonder what happened to the food we spilled and stuff. Because we did a lot, and the uncles, you know, all the women in the kitchen pretty well, except for a few, like she said, you know, few small aunts who
not one in the kitchen, nor anywhere else.
Oh, shoot.
There is such a strong evocation here. It's amazing that it can be so particularly Wales at a specific period of time and in a very specific social class, and yet at the same time be so universal, so that Midwestern Lutheran households of a different period should have so many similarities. I think he's managed to be both enormously particular and enormously universal. And it may very well be, and you know, I would have to study this a lot more than I have, that since feasting has so many common elements, that almost any account of feast makes an account, universalizes an account, because so many things cross time and place and culture where feasting is concerned. So that the particular dish may vary, and yet the teller's response to the dish is the one we recognize, whatever it was. And it's that, the response of the kind of excitement of it, the pleasure of it, the child noticing what he doesn't understand particularly, Auntie Hannah nipping away at the parsnip wine, and then the elderberry, where she's, you know, she's definitely taking advantage of the day, because it's only once a year. But her taking advantage of it is noted. He puts down those details without the commentary or interpretation.
it also be that in some ways the food is secondary to the feasting of the sights and the sounds and the colors and the feelings, that certainly is a large part of the feasting that he sees here, some of that outside the house even, that all contribute to it being a feast. I don't see a lot of detail necessarily about what the food was as much as the people and what was going on.
I think that's very true. In a way, it might remind us of the Sir Gawain passage in that the 15 days that that Arthur's household took to celebrate Christmas. I mean, it's not only the times you're sitting at the table. It's also the times that you're going to those services in the chapel, that you're doing the games and the jousting and the parties and the dances, and all of the thing together is part of the feast. And the outsides too, and also here, though the outside for the most part in this passage is not frightening, it's interesting to me that he does include that one little episode where they are frightened. And so they go back into the house with all the more pleasure in its security. And that reminds me of that, the way Graham structures when the animals get lost in the wood and find their way to Badger's house, the being out in the unfamiliar or cold or dark world makes our return to that warmth and feasting all the more impressive. It satisfies us more deeply because we're aware of the contrast between that and the other things. I think that also, that's probably very true in lot in feasting accounts, and it's certainly true in Sir Gawain, that the atmosphere that is set up there plays on the contrast between the terrible thing that is waiting for Gawain, the terrible encounter with the green giant who's going to come, the green knight who's going to come later on, or whom he has to find. That adds a potency to the pleasure of the feast feasting that he does. There's music. Did you notice that? You can't have a feast without music. There are these in this on page 15 in that one column. There are, three references to music: the caroling that the children do outside, in which they try to carry some of this to this strange dark place, and there is this mysterious response. Their music calls forth more music, so there is a kind of exchange, but it frightens them. They run away from it. And then there is the music that gets made in the house where the aunts and uncles or cousins sing. The cousin sings, and another uncle sings, and Auntie Hannah sings, and everybody laughs. And then he goes up through the window, sees the other houses on our hill, and hear the music rising up from them in the long, steadily falling night. So that this community is, in a way, connected with all the other households down the street as the music comes from all of those, whether it's literally heard music or it's music he imagines. It's in the air. It's part of the environment that he knows, that is present to him as he looks out the window. Well, it's a wonderful passage, and I think to me, it certainly speaks strongly of the timelessness that I believe is probably that experience is one that we must crave at some level. That freedom from the kind of inexorable nature of time. And feasting allows us to do that. I think that's true. For instance, if you occasionally have a really terrific, wonderful meal in a restaurant that is a really good restaurant, and it goes on and on and on and on and on and on and on, and you walk out of the restaurant, or you're closing it down, or you walk out and you say, "My goodness, it's midnight. We've been here since 7:30." You know, but it doesn't seem like a long time. Time in the feasting mode seems to vanish. Not if you're the cook. Though I think back to the scenes in Babette's Feast with Babette in the kitchen, and as they get to the final courses and as things are finished and she has gotten everything to work out and the last things have gone to the table, and particularly as the last things, this is probably why menus work this way, but the last things are not things you have to cook. The last things are the cheese, the fruit that goes out at the end, after the things that have been made. And she sits down with a glass of wine. And even the sight of all the dishes and all the labor and the thought that everything has gone out, her enjoyment of that glass of wine at the end of the feast is so palpable and strong. And it is as though that moment is as long as any of the preparation moments. It is as thoroughly experienced a moment as anything else she has done. Well, I found another wonderful example of timelessness, kind of by accident, that has to do with feasting. And this is from Lewis's The Last Battle. So that this is a section that partly, I think, could fit into reward. It's a scene at the near the very end of the series of Narnia tales, and the big battle that has been taking place, in which the kind of centerpiece of the battle is this stable, in which the terrible opponent, Tash, is supposed to be there, and to be there to eat up anybody who is thrown into the stable. So it's the center place of their enemies. Well, as the battle nears its ending, and the characters we care about have been being pushed closer and closer to the stable, and finally they get pushed right through the door of this stable. But when they are there, all of a sudden things change, and they notice that they're out on a beautiful hillside in the sunlight, looking around at each other, and there's no stable anywhere. There's just the stable door standing there all by itself, standing up under a tree, and there they look at it, wondering what on earth has happened to the rest of the stable. They're all standing out on this hillside, looking around in the beautiful sunshine, and everybody is fine. Everybody who had been in the battle and was bloody and dusty and defeated a few minutes before is now on this beautiful hillside, sitting there, and they can look at the door. So the door is there, but they can go up and look into it. I don't describe this as well as Lewis does. Tyrion, who is the prince, looked and saw the queerest and most ridiculous thing you can imagine. Only a few yards away, clear to be seen in the sunlight, there stood up a rough wooden door, and around it the framework of a doorway, nothing else, no walls, no roof. He walked towards it, bewildered, and the others followed, watching to see what he would do. He walked round to the other side of the door, but it looked just the same from the other side. He was still in the open air on a summer morning. The door was simply standing up by itself, as if it had grown there like a tree. It is the door that they came through, but once they were through the door, they were not in the stable where the door had led, but instead out on this beautiful hillside. They were also wearing all their beautiful clothes, and they looked just beautiful and kingly once again. Blue sky overhead and grassy country spreading as far as he could see in every direction. And all of them, all the friends, are back together. They have gone through the door, and the stable has disappeared. But then Lewis has another thing he wants to accomplish here before he gets to the very end of the book. So he brings up these dwarfs who have been a part of the battle, fighting against everybody, actually, fighting for the dwarfs, as they say. The friends are all talking among each other, and they look through the door. They look into the door, and through it, they can see that there here are a bunch of dwarfs. They're sitting in a circle, and they have their eyes covered. They have their eyes tight shut. They had a very odd look. They weren't strolling about or enjoying themselves, although the cords with which they had been tied seemed to have vanished. The dwarfs had been thrown into the stable as prisoners. And now they're all sitting there as prisoners, although there's no stable there anymore. Nor were they lie down having a rest. They were sitting very close together in a little circle facing one another. They never looked round or took any notice of the humans until Lucy and Tyrion were almost near enough to touch them. Then the dwarfs all cocked their heads as if they couldn't see anyone but were listening hard and trying to guess by the sound what was happening. "Look out," said one of them in a surly voice. "Mind where you're going. Don't walk into our faces." "All right," said Eustace indignantly. "We're not blind. We've got eyes in our heads." "They must be darn good ones if you can see in here," said the same dwarf, whose name was Diggle. "In where?" asked Edmund. "Why, you bonehead, in here, of course," said Diggle, "in this pitch-black, pokey, smelly little hole of a stable." "Are you blind?" said Tyrion. "Ain't we all blind in the dark?" said Diggle. "But it isn't dark, you poor stupid dwarf," said Lucy. "Can't you see? Look up, look round. Can't you see the sky and the trees and the flowers? Can't you see me?" "How in the name of all humbug can I see what ain't there? And how can I see you any more than you can see me in this pitch darkness?" "But I can see you," said Lucy. "I'll prove I can see you. You've got a pipe in your mouth." "Anyone that knows the smell of baccy could tell that," said Diggle. "Oh, the poor things, this is dreadful," said Lucy. Then she had an idea. She stooped and picked some wild violets. "Listen, dwarf," she said, "even if your eyes are wrong, perhaps your nose is all right. Can you smell that?" She leaned across and held the fresh, damp flowers to Diggle's ugly nose, but she had to jump back quickly in order to avoid a blow from his hard little fist. "None of that," he shouted. "How dare you? What do you mean by shoving a lot of filthy stable litter in my face? There was a thistle in it, too. It's like your sauce. Who are you, anyway?" Well, she goes on trying to convince them for a while, but finally almost gives up. When all of a sudden, Aslan, the great lion who is the lord of all, arrives in their midst. And as they're talking with him and greeting him, Lucy says this. "Aslan," said Lucy through her tears, "could you, will you do something for these poor dwarfs?" "Dearest," said Aslan, "I will show you both what I can and what I cannot do." He came close to the dwarfs and gave a low growl. Low, but it set all the air shaking. But the dwarfs said to one another, "Hear that? That's the gang at the other end of the stable, trying to frighten us. They do it with a machine of some kind. Don't take any notice. They won't take us in again." Aslan raised his head and shook his mane. Instantly, a glorious feast appeared on the dwarf's knees. Pies and tongues and pigeons and trifles and ices. And each dwarf had a goblet of good wine in his right hand. But it wasn't much use. They began eating and drinking greedily enough, but it was clear that they couldn't taste it properly. They thought they were eating and drinking only the sort of things you might find in a stable. One said that he was trying to eat hay, and another said he'd got a bit of old turnip, and a third said he'd found a raw cabbage leaf. And they raised golden goblets of rich red wine to their lips and said, "Ugh, fancy drinking dirty water out of a trough that a donkey's been at. Never thought we'd come to this." But very soon every dwarf began suspecting that every other dwarf had found something nicer than he had, and they started grabbing and snatching and went on to quarreling, till in a few minutes there was a free fight and all the good food was smeared on their faces and clothes or trodden underfoot. But when at last they sat down to nurse their black eyes and their bleeding noses, they all said, "Well, at any rate, there's no humbug here. We haven't let anyone take us in. The dwarfs are for the dwarfs." "You see," said Aslan, "they will not let us help them. They have chosen cunning instead of belief. Their prison is only in their own minds, yet they are in that prison, and so afraid of being taken in that they cannot be taken out. But come, children, I have other work to do." He went to the door, and they all followed him. He raised his head and roared, "Now it is time," then louder, "Time," then so loud that it could have shaken the stars, "Time," and the door flew open. Which is of course, the end of time in the Narnia book. So I thought this was a marvelous combination of feasts and time coming to an end, but also another idea that we have come to several times, that idea of the feast being, at least in some sense, that it's what you perceive, it is what you know it to be, what you understand. So that Shane could eat the pie and call it the best piece of stump he had ever eaten. It stands for more than it is. It stands for what the people who partake of it understand. And the dwarfs, who are determined to refuse the goodness around them, don't see it, don't partake of it. The feast that's in front of them isn't a feast, which is another thing we've heard before, you know, that this either is a feast or it isn't a feast. Food is just something you put in your mouth. If it is not, you know, in your mind, in your heart, in your understanding, it might as well not be there, because you don't receive it as feast. Certainly that's true in Babette's feast, that for the first part of that meal, at any rate, the old people are determined not to have it. And I was reminded of the Babette's feast group listening to the dwarfs, and that kind of determined rejection or refusal to accept, which does characterize some people's response to life and to goodness. And I think it's interesting that Lewis has Aslan say that he can't make them be any different. He can make the food appear. He can make a kind of magic feast. But he can't make the dwarfs take it, or like it, or appreciate it, or enjoy it. Which is a theme that Lewis sounds often. I think it's Lewis that says there are people who are lost, and I think this is in the Great Divorce, are the people to whom God says, "Thy will be done." People whose determination is to separate themselves from God. And these dwarfs, I think, are his version of that in this children's story. The determined refusal to see where they are and to accept that goodness. Do you remember evidences, those of you who've been here in other sessions, about that seem to you this timelessness concept in other things? Have we run across that before?
They form
a circle. Pretty ancient manifestation of Well, a lot of things, but also having to do with time, a kind of representation of solar time, of moving from ordinary time to special time or to something which is beyond ordinary experience. They don't just walk home as they might at some other time. They form this pattern, this very special thing, and they move around in the circle in a kind of dance. So it's quite mysterious in a way. It's not something that they would have expected of themselves, and not something that we expect of them either. And yet it seems like the perfect conclusion to what they have done. I suppose especially when the old man's hallelujah is added to it as he finishes off their circle. And some of those circles and ending feasts are the subject of what I would like to bring up for our attention tomorrow, Wednesday, when I get out of timelessness and back into time tomorrow. I think there are any number of even the things that we have discussed that we can see as a kind of closure. I'm not the only critic to have noted that the Dulce Domum section of Wind in the Willows, that section that we spent some time with, really should be the end of the book in some sense. It's a misplaced chapter in some senses. So we'll look again at that chapter, and you could, if you want to, rack your brains to think in your minds of some of those closing feasts that you have knowledge of or have experienced. Closing feasts. I've pointed out a couple that are, I think, not in the selections that you have, but that I thought might be relatively familiar. What did I say? Midsummer Night's Dream was one. And Lord of the Rings, yeah. There's a great ending feast in there. And then probably just for fun, and because there really isn't any other place for it, I thought we could also have Russell Baker's little game about feasting called Franks and Beans, which is just an amusing piece. Do you have other comments about Child's Christmas or Last Battle, timelessness, feasting?
The Emowitz wife, Jenny, when she was dying, had asked all of her friends what they thought heaven was. And as I had just finished Last Battle just before she asked that question, was like, and I was thinking of the door as death and the fact that immediately they are in no time. Mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden you aren't limited by time. As soon as you pass through that door, you have this great awakening, so to speak, or something, that you move up into the promised land or whatever. And I thought that was such a wonderful way of, telling a child that, but even for an adult, that was a wonderful way to think of timelessness in terms of all of a sudden you aren't limited by time anymore. Once you pass through that door, once you're baptized into your death, it's over. You're not limited by time anymore. Mm-hmm. That's immediately eternity, I think.
Yes, and there are many wonderful little things in that passage that I didn't read that have to do with how he describes how people, the various people, some of those characters died in a train crash, and others were in this battle, which is in some wholly different time system. But they all come to that door at the same moment. And having gone through it, all of their little pieces of time, which are all different because they're sort of in different worlds, they all stop. And they are then in this tremendous unity of a present, of an eternity, I suppose we would have to say. Except for the dwarves, who just resolutely refuse to acknowledge it. But it's true that, and that image of the door, that is one thing if you're looking at it from one side, and you have to go through it into what looks to you like a very dark and terrible,
dangerous
thing. But as soon as you have got to the other side of it, only just stepping across, it's nothing like what we thought it was. And then the reality of it just shifts or changes right at that moment.
I think it's interesting that they looked at the door, and then they went around to the other side of the door, and it looked the same.
Yeah, they couldn't get back anywhere. They couldn't pass back.
They couldn't. You know, it was, if you went through the door, but surely if you go around the door, you'd be able to see what's through the door,
yeah.
But
they couldn't,
you know, it looked the same. And I thought that was very interesting. There's lots of ramifications
in that. So that's kind of the timelessness, I think. Mm-hmm. And Babette's piece, you know, they were so desolate. It was such a desolate place where they were. They could hardly remember to believe anymore. They were just going at each other, and they couldn't forgive each other, the whole thing. And once they'd experienced this feast, this kind of foretaste, maybe the guy, all he could say was, hallelujah, because maybe it actually was what they were looking forward to. It was actually going to happen. And that there was that possibility again for them, which wasn't before. Mm-hmm. I don't know who saw the best piece, but just that was amazing to me. They had hope again, maybe, or something.
I couldn't figure out any way to get it into this list of things, because as far as I can tell, oh, well, it's not quite right. One of my favorite works is in another medieval English work called The Second Shepherd's Play, that some of you may... Second Shepherd's Pageant. Do you know that? It's one of those English medieval plays that was done to put biblical stories into a setting that people enjoyed. They were done at fairs and so forth. This particular text is particularly sophisticated and interesting because the writer collapses time in many ways. And he writes a story that is the nativity story, but at the same time, these shepherds are his contemporary shepherds, shepherds in Yorkshire in about 1495, which is when this text is from. And so they talk about current political conditions in Yorkshire, and they talk about the problems of being a shepherd on an English farm at that estate at that time. They talk about how cold and terrible it is, and they're very concerned about a fellow that they know who sometimes pretends to be part of their group, who's a sheep stealer, and is they're trying to guard their sheep against this guy. And at one point he comes in, only they don't know it's this fellow, he's in a disguise, and he does steal one of their sheep, and he takes it to his house. And his wife is very glad to see this, because they're going to kill the sheep so that it's a lamb, they're going to kill this lamb so that they can eat. But then the shepherds begin to catch on to who it is, and so they run after him. They run to Mac's house. They know this must be Mac. So they run to his house. And in order to try to fool the shepherds that they don't have the sheep, they put this lamb into a cradle next to the woman's bed. She gets into bed and covers herself up, and they pretend she's just had this baby. And they try to fool the shepherds into thinking that the thing in the cradle is the baby that they just had. And there are wonderful correspondences and juxtapositions as this wonderful playwright plays with all time being collapsed into this one drama. Because what happens in the plot is that the shepherds are taken in for a while, and at first they say nice things, and they say, oh, how nice, you've just had this baby, and I hope you'll be very happy. One of them is suspicious and says, I think that that's really our sheep. And Mac protests, and he said, oh, I swear, it's my baby. I would eat that rather than it were not my baby. You know, I swear that that's... I would just as soon eat this lamb as to tell you it weren't my baby. But the shepherds are suspicious, and they find it's a really their sheep, and so they take Mac and punish him. Actually, he was liable to death for stealing a sheep at that time, but they only sort of beat him up, and then they send him home. And then, after they've sent Mac off, they're standing around talking about what just happened, and the angel appears and sings Glory to God in the highest, and tells them to go to Bethlehem, where they will find the Savior of the world in a stable. And so they say, well, this is a marvelous thing, and they go off to Bethlehem. And the final scene of the play is these shepherds at the nativity in Bethlehem with Mary, and they each give a little present to the baby, so that all of the times are gathered into this one time. And there is a strong sense there, as there is in much medieval art, that in the realm of the sacred, and in spite of the fact that doctrine says God acts in history, there is a quality of timelessness to the life of faith, in which all believers participate in all the moments of sacred history. But there is no feast in it, unless I could say that two lines about the shepherd swearing that he'd soon eat this baby if it wasn't his real baby. I thought about it and could not make it work, but I recommend it as a beautiful work.